We are coming up to the last episode slash episodes of the season, and we'll have some news about the podcast for next year very soon. But for now, we're doing a throwback episode from earlier this year with one of my, Catherine's, favourite authors, Kevin Wilson. He's an American author and should not be confused with the Australian comedian. Hope you enjoy.
This is the First Time Podcast,
where we talk writing, publishing, and all of the feels.
It's conversations between us.
And conversations with Australian and international authors about their craft, their books, and the writing life. I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast, Season 6. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Kevin Wilson is the New York Times best-selling author of the novels Nothing to See Here, which was a Read with Jenna book club selection, The Family Fang, which was adapted into an acclaimed film starring Nicole Kidman and Jason Bateman, and Perfect Little World, as well as the short story collections Tunneling to the Centre of the Earth, winner of the Shirley Jackson Award, and Baby, You're Gonna Be Mine. His fiction has appeared in Plowshares, Southern Review, One Story, A Public Space, and Best American Short Stories. He lives in Sewanee, Tennessee, with his wife and two sons. Welcome, Kevin, to the First Time Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kevin, part of the reason we call this podcast The First Time is because we like to start at the very beginning. So tell me, have you always been a writer?
You know, I feel like the answer for most writers is it's expected to say yes, but no, not at all, really. I was always a reader, and it wasn't growing up in a kind of rural southern town. I didn't understand fully that writing was an option, that that was something that you could do. And I don't mean for a career. I don't know. It didn't fully occur to me that writing was this artistic pursuit that I could like take part in. But I loved books so much. You know, they were, like for so many writers, just these transformative texts that helped me like exist in the world. And so I think it took me a while to believe that I maybe could write. And it really was just such an overriding obsession with reading that I thought, oh, I would love to try this, right?
I'm interested, growing up in a small town, where did you get your books?
Oh, man. So I grew up in Winchester, Tennessee, and I don't want to make it seem like it's the middle of nowhere. Like, I think the idea of the American South as this kind of like agrarian society where there's just nothing but farms, and it's not true. Like, we had strip malls and fast food restaurants, but, you know, to get access to books was a little more difficult. There wasn't an indie bookstore in the 80s and 90s in Winchester, Tennessee. So I either had to drive to Nashville, Tennessee, about an hour and a half away, and that wasn't like plausible most of the time. And so I relied on the two libraries, which was one was the Franklin County Public Library, and then the school. I attended a small, tiny Catholic elementary school. There were six of us in my grade. The nuns would teach two grades at once. They would just turn around and teach fifth grade. While we did work, then they would turn around and teach sixth grade while the fifth graders did work. But I got to be good enough and a good enough student and responsible enough that they would let me, when I finished my work, I could do chores, which I would mop the floors or sweep up in the teacher's lounge. But they also would let me go to the library, which was a trailer outside, an unair-conditioned little trailer. And there wasn't a librarian there all the time. And I could just sit in there and read. And that was my first real access to books. And so many of the books were like from the 50s. I've said this before, but like there were so many books about kids with polio. You know, I was reading all these books set like in the 30s and 40s, kids making soapbox derbies. And so it wasn't like I could find like the Newbery Award winners or anything. You just had to make do with what you had. And so I read a lot of strange books over and over again, because that was the limits of what was available. And it was wonderful. I didn't complain. What I had was, it seemed like a bottomless well of books that I could read.
It's a kind of freedom too, isn't it? Being able to make those choices for yourself.
I mean, there's something to this day, that's so lovely and freeing about just walking along an aisle of books and knowing that any one of these you could open up. You know, this the possibilities has always, and especially when you're a little kid, you're allowed so little. You know, adults don't let you do much. So if they'll let you stand in front of the bookshelf for as long as you want until you find the exact one you're looking for, is kind of a special little feeling.
So, Kevin, you said that the idea of writing wasn't something that was necessarily there from the very beginning. What prompted you to start?
I mean, on some level, it was that I had read so much. And as I started to become a teenager, I realized, okay, somebody is doing this. Somebody's writing these. And you read enough that you start to see beats and you start to feel like connection to certain styles. And I thought, oh, I would like to try this. Let's just see if I can. And the thing that, you know, I think is it sounds silly now, and I mean it to be silly a little, but I first really started writing seriously, partly just because, like, I thought that was how I was going to get, like, people to fall in love with me or make out with me. You know, I don't know why at 18, I had such a misguided view of the world that I was like, oh, if I write a really good story, everybody in college is going to want to sleep with me. And this is just my way. This is my ticket in. And so in college, I was like, okay, Kevin, this is how it's going to work. You know, you're going to write a story. And then, you know, of course, like, there were no takers in the Make Out with Kevin Wilson group. Like, they weren't, no one was like, so, and then the glorious thing was, I was like, oh, I don't really care. Like, the stories, the writing of it gives me this kind of happiness and this insight and a freedom that is just, like, worth it on its own. You know, if you're going to be lonely, you might as well be lonely and write stories.
What a shame. It's not more of a, a way of attracting the opposite sex or parties. Do you remember the first thing that you had published?
Oh, yeah. So I think there's little things, like, there were student magazines, you know, at the college where I went to. But the first thing that I actually published in a real magazine that was not connected to me was just I was reading as a student at this university event, and there happened to be an editor there for a magazine in Virginia called 64 Magazine. And I read this story about a freeze in this small town that kills every single animal that's outside, freezes solid, and all the parents don't want their children to know. So they all take the animals to this giant pit to hide them. And the children wonder where their animals have gone. And the parents, you know, are playing dumb. And then the parents start to realize, when this thaws, like, what are we going to do? You know, there's this impending doom of lying to the children for now, but it's inescapable, right? Like, what will happen? It was a weird little dark, silly story. And they took it. And it was the first time where I thought, oh, okay, maybe some of these strange little things could be worthwhile.
It's interesting you use the word weird, because when you look at your work and interviews and commentary on it, the word weirdness comes up a lot, and it comes up in a really affectionate way. I think there's a sort of consensus that you write about weird things and unusual people with a lot of tenderness. And one of the things that you said in an interview, the question was about writers you admire, and you said, Amy Bender and George Saunders came to me when I was a college student, desperate to figure out how to write about weirdness with an open heart. And I feel like they pushed me in the direction that would become my identity as a writer. I could not love them more. With regard to weirdness, what direction did the work of Saunders and Bender push you?
I just want to go ahead and say, just, this is so bizarre, because I teach at a small university in Tennessee, and I had one of my beginning fiction workshops today. And it just so happened that I had assigned them two stories, and we read them.
Oh.
And it was The Rememberer by Amy Bender and Sea Oak by George Saunders. And at the start of this class, I was like, I read these when I was y'all's age, and they changed my life. These writers were the formative writers for me. And we talked a lot about magical realism and weirdness. And I said weird probably 1,000 times. So it's just so bizarre that you would remember that. But again, when I say weirdness, and I do mean it affectionately, and I do, you know, I just mean really and truly just anything that kind of seems to deviate in some way from the expected norm, you know, that it doesn't behave exactly the way that you can anticipate or expect. Mm. And a lot of times that's something that other people may not want to be around, right? Like that it's something that gives them pause. But I find that there's something really glorious when you really lean into something that deviates from the norm, that you say, I don't care that this is separate from what most people think is worthwhile. I'm actually just going to put my whole heart into it. And so for me, Bender and Saunders were the first two where I was like, oh, okay, one, there's humor in the way that they play with that weirdness. So it never feels horrific to me. It never feels cautionary, although it can be. But what it mostly feels like is a deep yearning to try to understand with some form of empathy what pushes people towards the ends of the spectrum, right? And both of them, I think, do it in really beautiful ways. And Saunders maybe in a more like social way, like trying to examine like the larger social structures that like force us to kind of bend towards the other ways. But Bender in a much more fairy tale, fantastic, slightly more magical way to me. But both of them just, you know, when you're 20 years old, and you know that you feel slightly outside or weird in your body, to have these two writers control that in such beautiful ways and feel real tenderness for their characters, even as their characters are just like destroying their lives or making terrible mistakes. That was heartening to know that you could still feel tenderness, even as these people kind of push themselves in places that are going to hurt them.
Mm. I do also wonder at times about that relationship between being weird and being lonely, and that there's sort of an intersect, I think, between those two things at times.
Yeah, and I think it can be self-selecting that you feel that weirdness. And so the places where you feel most comfortable is when you can interrogate that weirdness, and that's usually when you're alone, right? And I think then it you start to feel it so keenly that it drives you away from other people. But yeah, I find that weirdness and loneliness kind of go hand in hand. And a lot of my favorite writers, they explore loneliness, and often those stories are slightly weird.
Mm. Kevin, your debut novel was The Family Fang, and it's interesting. And a lot of people have said this, that it's interesting to look at that book alongside your most recent Now Is Not the Time to Panic, which came out last year. There are a few reasons for that. One is that thematically, they're both about art. We've talked about reading. What about art? Was art a part of your life growing up?
That's such a lovely question. And that's something that I get asked a lot about, the connections between those two books. And I think, so again, growing up in this rural place, my access to things was kind of limited. It was like what I could find on the radio or going to used record shops and kind of finding meaning in these things that I wasn't even sure how it was historically connected to anything. I wasn't sure if anyone even knew about it, you know, other than what I'd read. And I'll just never forget, there was this article in a music magazine called Spin Magazine. And it was about these graduate students at one of the California art schools. And it kind of profiled like four of them, but it mentioned Chris Burden, the performance artist who had, you know, someone shoot him. And I was, I don't know, 17, 18, 16. I can't remember. I know I was a teenager when I read that story, and I kind of looked up what I could find in the library about Chris Burden and about performance art. And it just moved me in such unexpected ways that I was watching these people make things that weren't typically what I'd ever heard of could be considered art. And that was super freeing. And to be in the middle of nowhere and to have access to very little and to feel so small in your body, to realize that like performance art, if I just treated everything that I did in my life as a kind of artistic enterprise, then I could be an artist in some way. Mm-hmm. And that was like a world opened up for me that, you know, no matter how small my circumstances, if I thought of this as an artistic enterprise, it could be that, right? The insistence upon a life lived as an artistic enterprise was huge. So I've just always gravitated towards those more avant-garde and more performance style art things, partly because it just was so mesmerizing to me.
There is a similarity in The Family Fang and Now Is Not the Time to Panic, not only in thematically having art, but the art is often made in secret, and you kind of have these opposites around secrecy and creation and then publicness and reception. And very often they don't line up. So, you know, I think The Family Fang, you mentioned performance art, they put on a range of performance art pieces that often the audience does not appreciate at all. I wonder about the relationship for you in being someone who creates and who writes between art and writing and secrecy.
Oh, man, that's lovely. And yeah, I think, so let me try to like organize this thought in a way that makes sense. But for me, The Family Fang, the Caleb and Camille Fang, their whole goal is to create performance pieces that disrupt, right? That deeply disturb the people who view it. And whatever, I don't have any opinions one way or the other about that desire, because I think that is an artistic desire. What I have trouble with and why I was fascinated by that family is that they wanted so badly to be there when it happened. You know, they wanted to see the people's faces. They wanted that it wasn't real unless they were there to be a part of it inside of the moment, being the explosion. And that appeals to me in no way, shape, or form. I don't want to ever be around. And so the loveliness of writing is that I can make this thing with my own two hands in my own time, and then I can send it out into the world. And I was just like, that's the safer thing for me. But I think what those two books both interrogate is that the Fangs are thinking, we want to disrupt. We want to make people feel something very specific, and we want to be responsible for it. And the danger of that, to believe that you can control another person's emotions, even if it's artificial. And then you look at Now Is Not the Time to Panic, where these two characters make the secret, beautiful thing just for themselves. They decide to share it with the world, and it immediately gets misrepresented. People have all these different opinions of it, and they have no control over it, right? There are just limits to what you can do beyond the making. You can make it, and that's all you can control. And you can't control really anything else about it. So there's a kind of a little bit of fear, even when I make those stories in my head and send them out into the world, that I know, oh, once it gets out, once it touches the open air, like my job is done. I can't control it at that point. And I can't really negate anyone's feelings about how they receive that. So they're both in some ways kind of similar in trying to interrogate like the made thing and then putting out the made thing.
That's interesting. Not so much linked with that, but relevant to the making process is you often write from the point of view of women. Is there something about writing from a female perspective that makes it easier or is helpful in some way?
I know I'm 100% aware of the fact that I gravitate towards, especially in the novels, female voices, right? So I'm aware of it, and I've certainly interrogated it. And you think I would have, after all this time, a better answer for why or like what I get out of it. And I think there's just a couple of things. Like, yeah, I do think it's like, for me, when I'm writing these narratives, I kind of like to disappear within them a little bit, even though they're deeply personal and I am inserting elements of myself into them. But I always, when I send out a work of fiction, I want plausible deniability about every single aspect of it. You know, I want to be able to say, if this was real, I would have told you it was real. So it's fiction, even if it's real. And so writing in the voice of a woman gives me a slight distance from the character. It puts a separation between me as the authorial voice and the character that I'm creating. And I don't think that that's like, I don't think anybody else is necessarily like, ah, well, that's why he's able to do the thing that he does. It's just for me, it gives me just enough distance to allow myself to emotionally connect and try to figure it out. And then there's just a weirder, smaller reason, which is just for whatever reason, there's something very comfortable for me about entering into the voice of a specific kind of woman. Again, like not all, you know, I'm not writing like a wide range of female experience. So it's not like I'm like, oh, I'm going to just write women all the time. I'm writing about women of certain circumstances that kind of are close to my own. But, you know, as I think about my own identity and the way that I grew up and the way I navigate the world and how I live now, there is something that's really freeing and lovely for me to exist for a brief period of time inside the perspective of a woman, and to appreciate that that's comfortable and that's good for me. And it helps me when I go back into the real world.
You also studied gender studies. Is that correct? Was that part of your studies at college?
Yeah. So I majored in English. I was creative writing major, but my minor was women's studies, which was all that there was at the time in the mid-90s. So I was a women's studies minor. And I would honestly say that most of that was because I had taken so many women lit classes that my advisor was like, you could do a women's studies minor if you just take two more courses. Because also I just gravitated to those classes where, you know, I never read all the big Russian writers. I didn't read Shakespeare in college. I always took the classes where it's like, we are going to read the lesser known works of Louisa May Alcott. You know, we are going to read all these Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Like those were the classes that I gravitated towards. They were super interesting to me. They felt like that they were deeply invested in trying to like uncover like aspects of literature that I hadn't previously read or thought about. And then when I graduated college, I moved to Boston and I worked in the gender studies program at Harvard. And I was really just a secretary and did research. But yeah, it was certainly a part of my life. And it was something, having spent a lot of my life kind of around women and listening to women and thinking about the kind of complicated ways in which their lives were different than mine, was certainly something that I would think about when I walked into these fictional worlds.
To keep coming back to this comparison between these two books, because they sit so well alongside each other. I am sure you have told this story many times, but I think it's interesting for listeners that might not have heard it. There is a particular phrase that appears in The Family Fang, and it comes back in Now Is Not the Time to Panic, and it's the real focus of the book. Can you talk a little bit about the phrase and where it originally came from?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the phrase is, the edge is a shanty town filled with gold seekers. We are fugitives and the law is skinny with hunger for us. And this is a line that I've said in my head probably two or three times every day of my life since I was probably 19 years old. It's just a repetitive thing that's burned into my brain. I just say it all the time. I don't even know exactly why anymore. It's just calming. This all started when I was 19, after my freshman year of college, in the summer before I started my next year. I was living with my cousin in an apartment, and one of his best friends was this guy, Eric Haley. They were both 4 or 5 years older than me. Eric had gone to NYU film school, had gotten his master's in theater and acting, and was about to move to LA after the summer. And so he was working and saving money, and he lived with us for that one summer. And Eric was incredibly handsome and incredibly charismatic. And I just kind of instantly fell in love with him. I just thought he was like the most interesting person I'd ever met. He had all video cameras and editing equipment. He would make short films and we would all three make them together. And he would tell me about books that he loved. And he was the first person that was my age who made me think that art was something that I actually could make, and that art was something that deserved to be made because of the pleasure that you got from it. And he just changed my life in so many ways. So then, just to quickly move through it, I was working for the medical center at the school where I worked, and my job in the early stages of the internet was that I was converting their huge policy and procedures manual into HTML to put it online for the first time ever. So I was just in an office for hours. No one knew what I was doing. And just by hand, I was typing the entire manual in HTML. It was just so boring. And I was 19 and I got pretty bored and just started making stuff up. And I would write anything that I wanted in the policy and procedures manual. No one ever noticed. No one ever said anything. So I kept writing more. And I would just write strange little lines, you know, in between these like very dry, like procedures manuals about like how to like requisition vehicles and stuff. And I told Eric and I said, do you have anything? And just on the spot, he said that line, the edge is a shanty town. And I put it online and it was there for a very long time on the internet and no one knew.
Did you ever go back and look? Did you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was there until like 2003, something like that. And actually my cousin told me he went on the Wayback Machine and found it as late as like 2008. It was still there, but it's since been updated and disappeared. But it's just a line that I always said, and it meant so much to me. It felt emblematic of a period of time when like the world seemed just so huge, and then it felt huge. And Eric made me think that like, oh, it's huge, but here's the little place where you can live, where you can do something that's important to you. And so I wrote that line and I keep using it because every time I think, oh, I'm done with it, I wrote it in Family Fang. It's just a tiny little tossed off line. And I thought, okay, that'll relieve the pressure in my head. And it didn't. And I was like, I'm going to have to make a whole book about it. And so I wrote, now is not the time to panic.
And has the act of putting that phrase so centrally into a book either changed the meaning or relieved the pressure of it?
That's a good question. I think it's too early for me to know. It has relieved some of the pressure. I still say it all the time, but it's really interesting. I've had other people say it to me. I've had people write it to me. I've had people show me pictures that they've drawn with the line on it. And it's deeply strange. Like, it's such a wild sensation to hear it, a voice that has been in my head. It's my voice for 20 years, and it's been the secret little voice that I say all the time. To actually hear it out loud in someone else's voice was a deeply strange experience that I did not expect. It wasn't bad, it wasn't good, it was just so unique that it was as if I had, you know, if you had been in a coma for 20 years and you awoke to this sound, you know, which was such a strange feeling. But I love it. I love that it's, you know, again, like, I love that it's out in the world, that it exists, that somewhere on the internet, that line will keep living, that when the Policy and Procedures Manual died, I figured out how to keep it alive. You know, I made sure that it would stay around a little longer, and that made me happy.
It says a lot about Policy and Procedures Manuals, though, and their sort of efficacy.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway.
Never got fired, never got sued, nothing never came of it. So it gave me at a very young age this sense of like, nobody's reading you. Like, so do whatever you want.
It's sort of performance art and secrecy bound up in it too.
Yeah.
Kevin, there's an article that you wrote for Time magazine. It's called, I Was Worried My Anxiety Would Prevent Me From Becoming a Good Father. In it, you write, and this is a long quote, but I really loved it. I used to really struggle with how I could live life with my children. I would think, how am I going to take care of them when I could barely take care of myself? I started to think about the saying, the strong protect the weak. That's the way a society should function. Those in power, the people who are strong and able, should protect those who can't protect themselves. But my worldview has changed radically since I've had kids. I've realized the strong don't protect the weak. They'll do it if it's in their best interests or if they feel like it. But people who are strong and in power find weakness repulsive. They don't want to be around it. They can't understand why it exists. I came to understand that the weak protect the weaker. I might feel like a damaged person, but I am always going to reach into myself and do as much as possible to protect my children, to give them a safer world. I'm sure that's hard listening to someone read your work. Back to you, but it resonated so strongly with me. And I found myself, my first instinct was to say, well, if you're protecting someone else, you must be strong, which attests to how much we think of weakness as being without virtue, that you know, I wanted to change what it meant. But it's something I find very hopeful. If we take this idea and put it to your creative work, how do you think about strength and weakness, either within characters or within family units?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think at the heart of it, you're right. Like that idea of like, what is weakness and what is strength, and why do we define them in the ways that we define them? And I think I'm going to struggle with this for the rest of my life, for as long as I live. And part of it is just like, you spend so much time thinking that you're damaged in some way, right? That you think that, oh, this prevents me from like becoming what I had hoped I could become. And more and more, I just like that idea of damaged is fine. Like, I do think there's something, some of my experiences as such have made it difficult for me to do the things that I wish I could do. But I may be damaged, but I'm not like broken. I still function. Like I still do the thing. It just requires me to work around those impediments, right? And that's been like, I think in some ways what I'm trying to do in my fiction is I'm trying to figure out narratives where characters who believe that they are broken learn the adaptive ways that they can still get the thing that they want, right? And so many of my stories are these kind of like, I don't know, they feel like puzzles where a character is like, here are the limitations that I have. How am I going to get what I need with these things in place? And it means that you have to get creative and you have to get weird. And sometimes you have to lean into dangerous or scary things, because at the end of it, maybe you get the thing that you want. I think I predicate like even my own writing off of that idea of like leaning into your own weaknesses and restrictions as a kind of creative way to do the thing that you want to do.
It feels like a very honest arc too, rather than that there's something appealing about transformation and that a character or a person transforms, but I think there's something more interesting in someone who sort of doesn't transform in the conventional sense. They more adapt.
I mean I don't want to get like too deep or too strange about it, but like my like as a writer, I predicate so much of my writing off of like what I can't do. And I actually think that's probably true for a lot of writers, that often writers, artists, athletes, like they're really what they are is kind of built around what they cannot do, what are the impediments that keep them from doing what they need to do. And that once you kind of recognize, okay, this is what I can't do, or this is what's harder for me to do, how can I still get what I want? How do I work around those things? And so your style in so many ways becomes like, symptomatic of like what you've had to work around in order to still achieve what you need to achieve. So like, just like a really quick example for me is like, I have a really hard time like writing head on about like serious things. Do you know what I mean? Like it's just not something I'm good at, to be like to write like big grand books about like the great American novel or big, huge like systems novels about the larger world. I'm not good at that. When I try it's too much for me to hold on to. So I'm okay, I can't write those big serious books, but I want to talk about those things. I want to talk about those things that are serious and important to me. So how am I going to do it if I can't come at it head on? And I'm like, okay, humor. Like I can be silly and I can have magic and weirdness and playfulness, and I'm going to use that. So I'll come at that same subject, but I'll do it in a way that seems silly at first. And I'll use humor to disarm the reader. And then if I can do that, I can wiggle my way into the subject matter that I want to write about. And I found my way into it in a way that's natural for me, in a way that lets me do it in a way that actually like works to my abilities. And the same way, like I grew up thinking like, how am I going to write stories set in New York City or like, you know, in Australia? Like I've never been anywhere. I've lived almost my entire life in the same county, you know, like so that was my weakness and limitation. And I thought, how am I going to do this? And then I thought, oh, I'm going to delve so deeply into the singularity of that setting, of that place that I've known my whole life, that I'm going to make it embody the whole universe. That if I can write exactly the way that I want about this tiny little place, I can render it in a way that might seem universal to people. So I was like, okay, that's how I'll work. I can't write about New York. I can't write about Seattle, Washington. I'll write about my place, but I'll write it in a way that I can hopefully get people to connect, even if they've never been there. And again, that's just my style. It's like, here's what I can't do. Here's how I'm going to get around it so I can still do what I need.
I guess in the same way that influences approach, limitations also influence the practical day-to-day, how, when you write and get words on the page. What does a typical or best case writing day look like for you?
Oh man, a day that I write is so rare that's a pretty good day if I do any kind of putting, you know, words on the computer. I barely ever write like what people think of as writing. Like I almost never write Like, I don't write 2 hours every morning. I don't write every day. I don't write every week. Sometimes I don't write for a month or two, partly just because of the way my life is constructed is, you know, I have kids, and I know lots of people have kids and still write, but just the way that my brain functions and my kids, when they need me, when my wife and I are together, when I'm in the moment, I just have to give myself over to it. I have to focus and concentrate or I'll slip away. So I just don't write, and I can put it away because I know it's the thing that I love so much that I'll always come back to it. It will always be there for me. And as long as I'm stoking those fires, when I sit down to write, I can do it. And so for me, a writing day is every single minute of the day, no matter what I'm doing, because I have this repetitive brain that at first seemed like a constraint. I'm just telling the stories that I'm making up in my head over and over and over and nonstop. And I'm thinking those stories through, thinking about a character. So any like little spare moment that I have during the day, I'm writing in my head so that when I finally get to the page, I can go super fast. You know, I can write really quickly, partly because I've just been letting it spin in my head for so long that it's kind of easy once I sit. But that's invisible writing. And if somebody mm-hmm. was like, how many words did you write today? I'd be like, zero. You can check back in a week and it will be zero. You know, I never know until I get finally that little opening of time where I say, this is where I can give myself over to the story. And I sit down and I go.
So in that internal process of thinking through a story, I mean, I can imagine a daydream where sometimes you sort of daydream to a point and then you think, oh no, I want to go back and change it. Like, do you go to the level of words when you imagine in your head a story, or is it just understanding the world and the things that the events?
A lot of it is, that's a great question. Cause I think like, yeah, a lot of it is just, I'm like, okay, here is this woman. Here's what she's doing in this moment. What are the things that like constrain that? So I start figuring out like, okay, what's the thing I need to think about? If she's going to do this, it will put her in this place. Who is the other person that will be in that space? And I'm just doing that a lot in my head. But then there comes the time, even in my head, and this is like when I'm washing dishes, like just because my brain, the way that it works, I'm just always kind of talking in my head. It's looping that eventually I do start writing sentences, you know, where it's like, yeah, I'm writing the sentences of the actual story and I hear it and I'm like, yeah, say it again. Okay, that would be a good, that will work. And I'm like, say it again. And it's like, okay, kind of. And I say it so many times, like, and I'm smoothing out some of the weirdness of it so that I can kind of get a sense of like what's at the heart. And then when it comes time to write, you know, it does feel like it's a little bit kind of already in there. And I just kind of got to find the momentum to make it get onto the page.
Wow, that is fascinating. Kevin, we always finish by asking writers two things. And one is writing advice. You've spoken a bit already about how you write, but what is the best advice that you have for other writers?
So the two things, and they're both very brief, is one is in college, we were all so young and we were writing these deep, dark stories where everything ended in death. We wanted them to be serious and important. And my professor was in his 80s, Walter Sullivan. He was so tired, you know, he was so tired of us, of trying to teach 19-year-olds. And at the end of another story where someone dies, I just remember he was so tired and kind of sad. And he just said, you know, if you ask your characters what they want, most times they're going to say, I want to live. And he was like, can you find a way to let them live? And I think he was just a little frustrated with us, but I took that to heart. And so in my head, the way that I thought of it is there a way that I can get this character from point A to point B and save mm-hmm. them? You know, and that's always my first impulse. Any story that I tell, I try to think, can I convey them with grace to the next thing? And sometimes the answer is no. You know, I try really hard. And sometimes the answer is just no, I can't. And here's where the story is going to work. But I try to extend, like, just go through every possible option. How can I get to that moment of grace in a way that will save the character? And oftentimes it's crazy how many times you can find it if you look for it, you know, if you try really hard. And so I always think about extending that grace that, yes, sometimes it will end in ruination. And yes, sometimes you will put your character through things that you yourself would never want to experience. But I try first to kind of exhaust my options. And I've found that helps me feel connected to the characters. And the last thing, it's so easy. And I know that it's said a lot, but like, everybody pretends and plays humble. Like, I was never the best, or I was this, but like, it's on some level, it really doesn't matter who is better and who is more talented, who is less talented. It really is just at some point I loved writing so much that I said it's worth failure and it's worth it never amounting to anything other than just the pure pleasure that I get from making it, that nobody can ever take away the generation from me, right? Even if the book never gets read, I never make any money, I'll always have the pleasure of making it. And once I kind of dug into that, I just thought, if I love it and I'm going to keep doing it, that I was going to outlast everybody, that I would just never allow myself to give up on the thing that I wanted to do. And I don't, you know, I know that I'm a good writer and I know I've worked hard to become a better writer, but so much of it was just the decision early on that I would do as much as I could. I would arrange my life in a certain way so that I could keep doing this thing that meant the world to me. And little by little, because I made that space, and each time I entered into a new phase of my life, I made that space that writing was still central to my life. And I think that's what paid off, that ultimately I was able to construct enough of a writing career that I could hold on to it. So there's writing is a lifelong pursuit. And I think people think, oh, the first book doesn't sell, that's the end of my career. And it's not. It sucks. And it's the worst. And I wrote two novels that no one took, but I didn't care because I did get pleasure out of writing those books. And they didn't go anywhere, but I still made them. And it meant when I wrote the third book, it was better. It was a better book than the first two. And I was ready to go. So I'm too obsessed to give up. And it let me get to where I wanted to go.
I think that's such comforting advice too. It takes the pressure off at the very least too, doesn't it? Like if there's nothing else you'd rather do.
If you hate every single second of writing, you know, if it is just pure torture to put words on the page and you derive no joy from it, then yeah, I might question my choices that I've made. Mm. But even when it's hard, it's pleasurable, you know, it's something that I love to do, so it's worth it.
Mm. Final question, which I'm now realizing I should have given you a heads up for. Kevin, do you have a favorite novel, favorite book? Could be from any time period, any genre, any author.
I do. Great. So my favorite novel of all time is by an American writer, Shirley Jackson, and it's called We Have Always Lived in the Castle. It's just such a transformative book for me. It's about a young woman, Maricat, who lives in this huge crumbling estate with her older sister and her uncle, and the rest of her family died by a poisoning. And they live this little life in this house, separate from the townspeople who hate them. And Maricat is strange and weird. And suddenly a cousin shows up, this man, Cousin Charles, who says he's a distant relative and comes to live in the house with them. And this makes Maricat so angry. And my wife tells me a lot that, like, she's like, you know, books that you think are happy endings are actually like unbelievably sad. And this is a book that is really dark, a little disturbing, but there's just something so wondrous about the way it talks about isolation and the worlds that we can make within these tiny constrained spaces. I love the voice of that character, Maricat, who is like slightly psychotic and strange. And it's a little house. I mean, this house where nobody gets to go in or out. And the ending is deeply scary. But for some reason, I always find joy because the obsession of the character, I give myself over to it. Even if what they want is bad, I'm like, if they get it at the end, even if it ruins them, I'm like, you got it. And I'm happy. And so wife always is like, Kevin, please stop telling people it's a great novel. Like, it's so sad, but I do love it.
I love that. I'm going to read that. Am I writing Shirley Jackson? You won the Shirley Jackson Award. Is that?
I did. Yeah.
It's a nice
short story collection.
Bit of circularity to that.
It's like the greatest thing I could have, if I could have chosen one award to win, it would have been that one. So yeah.
Ooh, that's a lovely note to end on. Kevin Wilson, thank you for being on the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much. I had so much fun. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.